The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth, and I'm here today with IJ Senior Attorney Tim Keller. We've been talking about disruptions to the educational landscape in 2020. And of course, one of those disruptions was IJ's case, which was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court this past term, Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. Tim, what was that case about?
So at its core, the question was, can a state exclude religious options for families who are participating in a school choice program? And the U.S. Supreme Court in June resoundingly said, absolutely not. If a state is going to enact a school choice program, if it's going to give parents options outside of their residentially district assigned public schools, then they must have a full range of options. The state cannot discriminate against religion just because it's religion.
Can you, for people who aren't familiar with the story of the case, what exactly happened? This had to do with a program in Montana that did just what you described, gave parents an option outside of the local district school. Why was it challenged? What happened? Why was it challenged?
So in 2015, the Montana legislature enacted a modest tax credit scholarship program. And it operates like so many of these programs do across the country. The legislature incentivizes donations from private individuals who write checks out of their own private bank accounts and give them to private charities, often called scholarship granting organizations or student scholarship organizations or simply scholarship organizations. And the scholarship organizations then bundle those donations together and award scholarships to private school students. And of course, the donor receives a dollar-for-dollar tax credit against his or her state income taxes. So that's the incentive, is the small tax credit that they get to lower their tax burden and their obligations to the state. The students, of course, then receive scholarships that their parents can use to send them to the school of their choice. And shortly after the Montana legislature had enacted this program, the Department of Revenue, the State Department of Revenue, which was tasked with implementing the program, looked at the Montana state constitution. And they found a provision in that constitution, which we at IJ routinely call a Blaine Amendment. And what this provision says, not verbatim, but just generally, is that the state shall not appropriate public funds directly or indirectly to sectarian schools. And so once and when they looked at that, the Department of Revenue said, oh, we have to adopt a rule that would prevent parents from using their scholarships at sectarian or religious schools. And that's exactly what they did. They adopted Rule 1 so that any family who received one of these privately funded, privately granted scholarships to attend the private school of their choice could not direct those scholarships, those funds, to a religious school. And so what happened was the Institute for Justice, on behalf of three families, including two single moms, filed a lawsuit in state court challenging that rule. And we, in the state court, we made three arguments. Number one, that the program doesn't involve any appropriation of public funds in the first place, because no dollar ever entered the state's control. In fact, what was happening was you were directing private dollars to private organizations, to private parents who directed them to private schools. Private. No public involvement at all. And that particular argument has prevailed in every other one of IJ's cases involving scholarship tax credit programs. So that was argument number one. Argument number two was that the Department of Revenue, in adopting this rule, had amended state legislation, and that was simply beyond the power of a executive agency to do, because it was so clear that the state legislature intended to give parents a choice between public schools, or if they're participating in the program, between both private non-religious schools and religious schools. It was all supposed to be up to the parents. And then finally, we said that even if the Montana Constitution could be construed to require the exclusion of religious schools, that would violate the federal constitution. Because under federal law, the government is supposed to be neutral with regard to religion. It's not supposed to favor religion over non-religion or one religion over another. The government's role is to just be hands off. And so that was the state of affairs when we filed the lawsuit. And we prevailed in the trial court on all three grounds. We ran the table, and the rule was enjoined, and families like our clients were able to receive scholarships and to use them to send their kids to the school of their choice. But the Department of Revenue appealed to the Montana Supreme Court. We went directly to the Montana Supreme Court. There's no intermediate court of appeals in Montana. And the argument went well. We thought for sure we were going to prevail, because it was one thing seemed abundantly clear, which was that that the state Supreme Court agreed that the rule itself was beyond the scope of the department's power. And in fact, when we got the ruling from the Supreme Court, they said, indeed, executive agencies can't amend duly enacted legislation and pass rules that so clearly conflict with the program itself. But the court didn't stop there. They said that now that the rule is gone and families have a free choice, we have a program in front of us that includes religious educational options. And the court said, we believe that that is a form of indirect aid to sectarian schools. And because there's no way for us to rewrite the statute to take those options away from religious families, we have to strike down the entire program. And so even though it was IJ and the parents that we were representing that had brought this lawsuit, just challenging the rule, what we got for our efforts was a win and a loss. And it wasn't just a loss for our families. It was a loss for every family in Montana who wanted to access the program, because the Montana Supreme Court struck down the entire program.
So they struck it down based on the Montana Constitution. IJ appealed it to the U.S. Supreme Court. For people who aren't constitutional attorneys, how does that work? I mean, it seems like the state constitution should govern what happens in the state. And how does that interplay with the federal constitution work in this program or others like it?
Yeah, so states and state constitutions are free to provide greater protections than the federal constitution, but the federal constitution establishes a baseline that no state constitution can infringe. And so what we argued here was that the construction that the Montana Supreme Court had given its Blaine Amendment was violating the federal constitution, a guarantee of religious neutrality and religious freedom for parents. And the court agreed. And of course, you know, we had to ask the U.S. Supreme Court to take what's called certiorari in this case. They grant cert in only a small number of cases. So we were, of course, not entirely surprised, but definitely very excited and overjoyed when the court took the case and said they will consider this issue, because this was an issue that IJ has been facing for almost 30 years now. The question of whether state constitutional provisions can be construed to require the exclusion of religious educational options when the state passes a school choice program. We'd seen that argument time and time and time again, beginning with the very first school choice program that was enacted in Milwaukee in 1991, to challenges in Illinois, Arizona, Georgia, Florida. And time again, IJ had been successful in making one of two arguments. In the context of scholarship tax credit programs, we consistently won our argument that school choice programs, that tax credit scholarship programs did not involve the appropriation of public funds, and therefore these state constitutional amendments didn't apply in their first clause. But then even in the context of publicly funded programs, we had made the successful argument time and time again that these programs were not aid to institutions. They were not aid for sectarian schools. These are generally available benefits provided directly to families to make the best choice for their own children, and that no parent was constrained to enroll their kids in any particular school, much less a private or much less a religious school, that these were programs of true private choice, and that they were designed to benefit families and students, not institutions or schools.
And so those are the cases that were happening at the state level, state Supreme Courts. What about the context for the Supreme Court? When they took this case up, what other cases informed their decision? What were the cases that IJ leaned on in our arguments? How does the past rulings of the court, how do they come into play in Espinoza in particular?
So there are three previous Supreme Court decisions that really came into play in the Espinoza case. The first, it was a case called Zelman v. Simmons-Harris. This was an IJ case that arose out of Cleveland, Ohio. In what happened in Ohio was that the state had enacted a scholarship program for low-income students who were trapped in one of the worst performing public school districts in America in Cleveland. And they empowered those families to use their scholarships at both public and private schools. So in the way that the Cleveland program was set up was that a family could take their scholarship and use it at a neighboring public school, or they could use it at the private school of their choice, including religious schools. Now, when we took that, and we won, they first filed that lawsuit in state court using provisions similar to the ones we just talked about, and we prevailed in the Ohio Supreme Court. And then they filed a collateral attack against that program in federal court, saying that it violated the federal Constitution's Establishment Clause. The provision says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion because families could choose religious schools. And in fact, the fact situation on the ground was that many of the public schools refused to accept the scholarship programs. And so the schools themselves were refusing to allow parents to use them at public schools, and that the parents who were receiving them and using it at private schools overwhelmingly were choosing to use them at religious schools. And so that was the fact context upon which we took the case up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in Zelman, the U.S. Supreme Court said it does not violate the Establishment Clause for the government to give families a private school scholarship and allow them to choose religious schools, so long as the principles that we've already talked about were true. Number one, that the state was neutral with regard to religion, that it wasn't putting its thumbs on the scales and trying to you know, coerce parents to choose one school over another. And number two, as long as parents were exercising a true private choice. And I mean, really, those are mirror images of each other, right? But as long as the government was neutral and parents had a private choice, those programs did not violate the Establishment Clause. But of course, in Zelman, they didn't answer the question. Even though they answered the question, can religious schools be included in the program? Yes. They didn't answer the question, could religious schools be excluded? That was an open question, although certainly the simple fact that they were requiring neutrality suggested an answer to that question, that if we were going to get it up there, we would win. So that was the first case. The second case that was involved in Espinoza was Locke versus Davey. This was not an IJ case, but it was a case that IJ had weighed in on and as an amicus brief, and our arguments did not prevail in Locke versus Davey. So in Locke, what happened was the state of Washington operated a private post-secondary scholarship program. So students could get scholarships from the state, state-funded scholarships, to attend private colleges. And the program allowed students to select both religious and non-religious schools, and even to use their scholarships to pay for religious educational courses at the religious colleges if that's where the students attended. But there was a student by the name of Joshua Davey who wanted to use his scholarship not just to attend a religious school and not just to take religious classes, but actually to pursue a major in what was in the case referred to as devotional theology. Basically, he wanted to be trained to become a minister, a teacher of religion. And the state of Washington said, well, we're not going to pay for that. We'll pay for we would pay for your scholarship at the school if you were pursuing a secular degree, but not if you're going to choose this religious vocation. And Mr. Joshua Davey challenged that exclusion, and that case went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the court actually upheld Washington State's authority to exclude that one narrow category of instruction. And the court said that there is some play in the joints between the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause of the U.S. Constitution, because what Joshua Davey had been asserting was that by excluding him from the program, they were violating his free exercise rights. So the court said, sorry, Mr. Davey, what the state is doing in your specific case is okay. And so that left us with some tension, because the Washington program wasn't a complete exclusion of religious options. It was not a wholesale exclusion. It was this very narrow category of instruction. And then just 2 terms ago, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its third case that was relevant in Espinoza, which was Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia. And in Trinity Lutheran, the court said that the state of Missouri could not rely on its state constitution to exclude a church from a state-funded grant program that gave schools, preschools in this particular case, state dollars to resurface their playgrounds using recycled scrap tires. And the court said, look, this the program, what the state of Missouri is doing is just discriminating against religious institutions because they're religious institutions. The state is pursuing both environmental concerns and safety concerns by, you know, eliminating these scrap tires from landfills and providing students with a soft surface to land when they fall off the monkey bars. And it's unconstitutional. Actually, they said it was odious to our constitution to exclude those church-run preschools from the program simply because they're religious. But the court dropped a footnote and said, but we're not answering the question of whether or not the state could exclude religious schools if, for example, the recipients were actually using their state dollars to fund some sort of religious education or religious use, as the court put it in Trinity Lutheran. And that was the state of affairs when we brought the case before, when we brought the Espinoza case to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So what was the, in Trinity Lutheran, you make the point about talking about how the money is used. What was the breakdown among the justices in that case? Was it a five, frankly, in all of these cases, how closely is the court divided on this issue?
So both, the Zelman case was a 5-4 decision in 2002. Lockby Davie, just a couple years later, was actually a 7-2 decision. And Trinity Lutheran was also a 7-2 decision. But in Trinity Lutheran, there were only 6 justices who signed the majority opinion, and 1 justice who wrote separately in a concurring opinion, concurring in the outcome, but not joining the reasoning of the majority opinion. But the footnote that I just referenced was only joined by 4 out of the 9 justices. And so we were in a really bizarre counting situation when we went in front of Espinoza, because we certainly thought the Espinoza case was putting that footnote from Trinity Lutheran squarely in front of the court. Can a state exclude religious educational options because those families were using those scholarships to obtain a religious education at the schools? And after the oral argument in Trinity Lutheran last January, we walked out the door and we said, you know, I think what the court's going to do here is just extend Trinity Lutheran reasoning to the school choice context, but dodge and duck the question of, you know, religious uses entirely in our case. And in fact, that is what happened. In Trinity Lutheran, the court said, look, the Montana Constitution discriminates against religious schools for no other reason that they are religious schools.
And or in that Espinoza, was, you mean?
Espinoza, yes. I'm sorry. So Espinoza, the court said the Montana Constitution is discriminating against religious schools simply because they're religious schools. It says no indirect aid to sectarian schools. That was the reasoning that the Montana Supreme Court embraced when it was striking it down. And so this is a fairly straightforward application of Trinity Lutheran, but they said in so much clearer language that any state that chooses to enact a school choice program cannot rely on its state constitutional provision to exclude religious schools simply because they are religious schools. And so in that fashion, and in a way that was not clear post-Trinity Lutheran, it's abundantly clear that state Blaine amendments, state constitutional provisions that would could be read to exclude religious options from school choice programs are a dead letter.
So it sounds like there is a fair degree of consensus on the court that the idea that the fact that these institutions are religious in nature shouldn't disqualify them. But when it comes to that question of how the money is actually used, there's a lot more concern on the part of the court or on the part of some justices. that you talked a little bit about how that question played out in Espinoza, but I wonder if you could get to that exact question. Did they end up talking about, you know, the what goes on in religious schools? Like if they're too religious, if they're more close to that ministerial, you know, where they're training someone in a certain religious tradition, when is it too much? Maybe they're not going to be a minister, but they are hearing everything from a particular perspective. Did the court give any comment on that sort of that tension?
So if it did anything, it really almost shut the door on that religious use argument, at least when it comes to the context of empowering parents to choose the education for their children. Because the court did a couple of things in Espinoza. So number one, the court did recognize Locke v. Davy is out there, that there is some small play in the joints, but the court really repudiated many of the arguments that opponents of educational choice had tried to use when marshaling Locke v. Davy in their favor. The court said, look, the program in Locke went a long way to including religious educational options and only carved out this one very narrow category of instruction. And by the way, that category of instruction historically was of concern to the states when adopting their own state constitutions. Many of the states early in our country's history actually did try to provide funding for ministers, typically by actually selecting ministers of one particular religion to fund over others. And many state constitutions prohibited that practice. And so the court said there was a substantial and historic justification for excluding instruction or payment of dollars for ministers. Although in both Locke and again in Espinoza, the court said there would be no federal constitutional violation if states chose to fund that sort of instruction. It wasn't constitutionally prohibited under the federal constitution, but if states wanted to construe their state constitutions to exclude that one narrow category, that was permissible. So Espinoza recognized that there was an exception, but it was very narrow. And they went on to say that if a state were going to try and exclude private schools because they were using the dollars for religious education, that any such regulation would have to pass strict scrutiny. So strict scrutiny is the highest level of review that a court will employ when looking at a constitutional challenge to a program. And it means that in order for this, basically it means that the court is recognizing that one, a restriction on religious use would actually be an impingement, an infringement on religious freedom and parental freedom as well. And that the state would have to come forward with a compelling governmental interest to justify the exclusion of religious options because families were using them to obtain a religious education. And so the court said, look, number one, we have recognized for 100 years that parents have a fundamental constitutional right to direct the education and upbringing of their own children. And so if a state wants to empower parents to exercise that right and put conditions on it, particularly conditions that would prohibit them from choosing religious schools, you got to meet strict scrutiny. And then number two, you got to come forward with a compelling governmental interest. And they said, you know, and it's not enough to just say, historically, we don't want to fund religious schools, because the court said, in fact, historically, states often did embrace religious schools, both state-funded religious schools in the form of the religious schools being the state's actual public school system. There was a time when most of our country's public schools were actually Protestant institutions and Protestant in orientation. But it also was also very common for the states to just provide grants to families to choose the school of their choice. And so religious schools have been part of the fabric of our educational system for hundreds of years. And so the court said there's no historic and substantial interest in just excluding religious schools from school choice programs for that reason alone. They also said that, look, religious schools and religious individuals are a part of our communities. And when a state is going to pass a program, to exclude them would also be odious to our Constitution in the same way that the exclusion of the preschool and Trinity Lutheran was odious in that case. And so the Chief Justice who wrote the majority opinion in Espinoza again concluded the opinion by pointing out that excluding religious options, religious families from these programs is odious to our Constitution. So for all those reasons, even though the court left open the door to some sort of argument that maybe a restriction included in a program to try and limit the use of educational choice programs at religious schools that provide religious instruction could pass muster. I really think what happened was the court, if anything, the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice is slowly working to close that left open gap from Trinity Lutheran and now a smaller gap from Espinoza. But the Chief Justice tends to write narrow opinions, take things in a very incremental fashion. He doesn't rule on issues that he doesn't have to rule on. And in Espinoza, he didn't feel like he had to reach that issue. But if that issue were to reach the court tomorrow, I think the court, at least in the context of school choice programs where parents are making the decisions, would say no exclusions from programs based on religious use. Religious schools teach religion. Parents want their children to enroll to those schools. That's perfectly fine.
Well, that actually gets to one of the things that came up a lot in the wake of the decision in the media. You know, there were a lot of stories written about the cases. There were about, you know, every Supreme Court case towards the end of the term, especially. And a lot of those stories really raised the specter of the church-state separation. You know, the idea that with this decision, the court has gutted protections for, you know, people who don't want to be funding religion or who really value rightly that separation between church and state. So is it true that with Espinoza, what the court effectively did was say, you know, states have to fund these religious schools? They've really lowered that barrier in a way that it previously wasn't lowered.
No, not at all. So if a state does not want to enact an educational choice program, if it doesn't want to provide options for parents outside of the state-funded public schools, it does not have to. So the ruling does not mean that the state has to provide funding for private schools, religious or non-religious, along the same terms that it provides funding for public schools. So states are still free to choose to fund public schools only. But what Espinoza does, I think it actually protects religious freedom, protects it prohibits the state from establishing a religion of secularism over just genuine free choice. So what the Espinoza decision really ensures is that no government official, high or petty, is choosing which doctrines or what should be that children should be learning in the schools of their parents' choice. And in this way really preserves and increases the wall of separation between church and state by ensuring that when the state does empower parents, it's really the parents who are making the choices for their kids and not some state official. It ensures that the state cannot, and again, this is a really firmly established constitutional rule, cannot favor non-religion over religion or religion over non-religion. It's simply the role of the government to be neutral.
And this decision just really reinforces that idea that, you know, it's a legitimate government purpose to try to provide for education, to try to give the families who are maybe not receiving an adequate education in their current public school setup, that's a legitimate use of state money to try to give them better options. Then once it decides to do that, hands off.
That's right. That's exactly right. The government needs to be hands off, take their hands off the wheel at that point. And you know, even though so many of these arguments tend to be framed in terms of religious schools, because they are right now the predominant form of private schooling in America. Of course, that's the one thing you can't get in a public school. You can't get a religious education. So it's not surprising that the current market has a large number of religious schools as options for parents. But you know, as programs are enacted and give parents genuine educational choice, it wouldn't surprise me if we see a shift in the educational marketplace to include new forms of educational options for parents. Maybe in what we would consider a traditional brick and mortar private school, but they could be something entirely different as well. You know, we're living in a really interesting period of history with this pandemic. We're seeing both public and private schools not offering in-person instruction, trying to put together some sort of virtual instruction or hybrid, or even if the schools are open, parents aren't certain that their children, they want their children in those schools right now. And so we're seeing what you might argue is just a really grassroots movement of parents who are trying to put together new educational options for their kids and instruct them in new and interesting ways. There's a new phrase out there, the pandemic pods, which is really popped on this the scene in the last couple of weeks. And these pods are simply parents who are working together, pooling their own resources together to provide instruction themselves or to actually hire teachers or private tutors to come in and work with small groups of kids to provide them a quality education.
So in a post-Espinoza world, just to kind of close this out, with respect to the law, what is on the table? Obviously the principle of neutrality, very important. You can't pass a program and then exclude, the religious schools from participating. But, like you said, this is a truly unique time in the history of our country, in the modern realm anyway. How could, as legislatures across the country grapple with that, what is on the table for them as they look to provide educational options or as they learn, they look to improve educational outcomes for the families that are in their area?
So there are 37 states that had constitutional provisions similar to Montana's. And what Espinoza did is it removed all of 37 as legal impediments to legislatures considering and enacting school choice programs. And it really just cleared the deck to give legislators free and independent choice to craft programs that are going to best meet parents' educational needs, both now and into the future. And so state legislatures in all 50 states are free to consider programs that are going to empower parents to make choices for their kids' educations. These could be what we might consider a traditional scholarship or voucher program, where the parents are given a scholarship to attend a private school or a nearby public school that perhaps that they're not allowed to enroll in because of district boundaries. So you could give parents choice that way. But you can also design programs like education savings accounts and really set those dollars aside in a parent-controlled account and allow them to spend it any way they want to truly personalize, individualize, and tailor their child's education, whether it's at home, online, in a private school, or some mix thereof. It's really the sky's the limit. If legislators are willing to act, Espinoza has empowered them to empower parents.
Thank you so much, Tim, and thank you everyone for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find more on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. There's another IJ issue you'd like to learn more about. You can email me at melanie@ij.org, and we may feature it on a future show.